Delighted to introduce Janet Reutemann, Professor of Anthropology at the New School for Social Research and former research fellow at CNRS. I've been looking forward to this seminar literally for a couple of years. And then when we finally got around to a date that would suit both of us for visiting and spending a couple of days in Helsinki, COVID-19 happened. Sadly, we'll have to plan that for sure for a future date. But in the meantime, I'm extremely grateful to Janet Reutemann that she's been willing to be up at this time in the morning in New York to present her paper to us. And thanks to the audience for appearing a little bit early as Professor Reutemann has to leave at 10:30 a.m. sharp her time. Now, she really does need no introduction, as she's one of the top anthropologists of fiscal and financial relations in the world today. She's also one of a handful of anthropologists working in the Anglophone world that crosses over into the Francophone anthropological sphere and makes equal use of both scholarships. And I think that's more of that is needed. Her book, Fiscal Disobedience, introduced me to her work and convinced me, as well as most of the rest of anthropology, to follow her work ever since. The book concerns fiscal and commercial relations in the Chad Basin, a multiply bordered region that covers northern Cameroon, northeast Nigeria, Chad, and the Central African Republic. It includes a study of the kind of civil disobedience, in 93, in which people refused to pay their taxes. But most of the book concerns a variety of bandits, itinerant traders, corrupt officials, and whatnot, who make money by perpetually crossing borders. The phrase population flottante, which I absolutely love, was used by the French colonial authorities to describe these kinds of constantly border transgressing traders, a sort of floating population, something that was anathema to the colonial authorities, whose concept of state, territory, and fiscal governance required populations to stay put. The way Reutemann weaves ethnography, historiography, and deep conceptual knowledge of the kinds of classification systems that led to this clash makes for one of the most dashingly impressive anthropology texts I have read. Now, I'll just provide one quote from the book which captures a key point Reutemann makes about the troubles the French colonial logic had here. And I quote, efforts to institute colonial law and constitute the legal subject via ordered knowledge of society, in quotes, and enumeration were confounded by unaccounted motion, e.g. vagrancy, which in subverting demographics also challenged the law, end of quote. It's a fabulous book. I really recommend it to people. Reutemann's next book, Anti-Crisis, which considers the fiscal and financial crisis that began in 2009, takes to task the concept of crisis, arguing that you have to assume that crisis exists in order to say you are in it. In that sense, crisis is a blind spot. You know a crisis when you see one, but you have to assume you already know what it is before you can have one. She also argues that the concept is a deeply conservative one, implying that the best way to get out of crisis is to try to get back to the position you were in before you were in it. Again, a highly inspiring book that I strongly recommend to anyone who wants to have their unexamined assumptions stretched to breaking point. Now, she has many other publications and achievements to her name, but in the interests of time, she has to stop promptly at 10:30 her time, I'll now stop talking and invite Janet Reutemann to give her talk for today, Africa Rising, Class or Finance. Janet, and I will start sharing the screen.
Actually, Sarah, just before you, I just want to say thank you. Those were extremely generous remarks. I always assume that not that many people are interested in finance and taxation, to be honest, so let alone the anthropology of it. So I really appreciate your comments and the invitation. And thank you all for showing up on your late Friday. I really appreciate it. Unfortunately, when we share, I won't be able to see everyone. I always find that really disconcerting on Zoom, but such is such it is. So thanks. I guess you can do that now so I can figure out my notes. So just 1 minute while I fix the view option. Great. So I guess the thing I would like to do is to start just by commenting on how I got to this project, this Africa Rising Class or Finance. It seems like a big shift from Anti-Crisis. But actually, when I was doing research for Anti-Crisis, which, as Sarah just mentioned, sort of took the Great Recession of 2007, 2008 as kind of not really a case study, but it was sort of the event that I was thinking through. And so the research for that book, you know, really involved reading the Financial Times, like religiously. So I'm reading the Financial Times over, you know, a course of a year or two, and out of the corner of my eye, I keep seeing an enormous amount of reporting or an unusual amount of reporting on Africa. And so I was dumping those into a file because I didn't have time to read them. And when I finished Anti-Crisis, I went back and read through that reporting. And it was basically all about the emergent middle class in Africa. And at the time it was dubbed Africa Rising, hence the title of my talk today. And I was thinking through this material, I realized if this is correct, right? If there is a consolidated middle class across the continent, this is the biggest story since colonization, right? At least in terms of structural transformation on the continent, right? A solid middle class reproducing itself in most countries in Africa. That's perhaps the biggest story since colonization. So, you know, this was pretty striking. So I decided to do a review of the literature, as one does. And I took Africa Rising as kind of the thing that I was looking into. And what I found were development economists, no sociology and no anthropology. I should be, to be fair, there is a recent, but like quite sparse kind of reaction publications in anthropology, some sort of hastily put together edited volumes, some of which are decent, you know, they're good, but it's pretty sparse. So I was curious as to why. How did we kind of miss this kind of story of the middle class in Africa, meaning anthropologists and sociologists? So I looked into it, and that's what I'm presenting today. So what is at stake? And this is actually what I learned. What is at stake are financial information systems. Africa Rising is as much a story about London as it is about Lagos. And that's what I hope to explain today, right? It's as much about London as it is about Lagos. My ultimate aim, and I think this is maybe what we can talk about in the question and answer period, is to draw a link between this current project and anthropology. And specifically to the question of what we take to be appropriate or legitimate ethnographic objects, right? It's like a longstanding interest, and it's still there. So can you give the first slide, Sarah, please? Thanks, thank you. So in 2008, the South Asian social entrepreneur Vijay Mahajan published the book Africa Rising, which you see on your screen, How 900 Million African Consumers Offer More Than You Think. This expression, Africa Rising, has dominated the financial press, as I just mentioned, and popular accounts of the continent's trajectory. Next slide. But if we look carefully, already 20 years ago, Time Magazine, 20 years ago, featured Africa Rising on its cover. The corresponding article was subtitled, A New Spirit of Self-Reliance is Taking Root Among Many Africans as They Seize Control of Their Destiny. That's the subtitle. Next slide. The Africa Rising narrative was repeated in The Economist. This is actually the cover, which published a report in 2011 entitled Africa Rising, the Hopeful Continent, that focused on GDP growth and especially the commodities boom of the early 2000s. Next slide. And shortly thereafter, and this one was very influential, the 2012 cover of Time Magazine featured an image of the archetypical oversized African baobab tree, which you see here, its long branches sheltering not elders in a palaver, but rather the black and gray frames of a nondescript industrial urban landscape. The words "Africa Rising" hover in the tall branches of the tree with the subtitle, "It's the world's next economic powerhouse, but huge challenges lie ahead," end quote. Next slide. So here you can see the two covers. The magazine articles cited above are replete with iconic images of empty savannas littered with roaming fauna, you know, like lions and et cetera, as well as overcrowded slums being transformed, sort of as you thumb through these glossy pages. Next, can you put the next slide? So the slums are kind of transformed as you flip through these magazines into these glistening shopping malls, neat single family homes, and next slide, of course, cheerful smartphone carriers. But perhaps more stunning than these magazine depictions and representations are the country and industry reports produced by the international financial consultancies. So next slide. The most notable and oft-cited, this one is cited like through everything, is the 2010 report published by the McKinsey Global Institute entitled "Lions on the Move, the Progress and Potential of African Economies." And 2 years later, the private consultancy Deloitte published a report called "The Rise and Rise of Africa's Middle Class." Next slide. And in September 2016, so you know, 5-6 years later, McKinsey Global Institute published "Lions on the Move 2," which documents, and I want to hesitate here to say it documents, but it sort of forecasts, right? This is McKinsey, right? So it sort of forecasts immense economic transformation on the continent. The overall focus of these industry reports is on the magnitude of this new middle class, right? The questions they ask, and literally are, how fast will the lions move? How big is their roar, right? They ask these kinds of questions about, and referring sort of, you know, metaphorically to the middle class. But those who have debated these reports are not anthropologists or sociologists, they are development economists. And they've engaged in really intense debate over the extent and the nature of the contemporary middle class in Africa. And this is a really complex debate. Development economists have produced these painstaking analyses that focus on definitions and on analytics. And in reading that literature, which I did, you know, I sort of dove into these discussions over what to measure, how to measure, and the effects of measures. They're really interesting discussions, and they're concerned with the policy implications of how the middle class is qualified and therefore quantified. It is sort of a very Michel Calon kind of thing. However, ultimately, despite this really rigorous work, the development economists fail in their attempt to specify, or really to kind of essentialize, what is an extremely heterogeneous category, right? The middle class, by definition, is an extremely heterogeneous category. So, you know, indeed, from my point of view, they ignore two decades of research from the 1960s through the 1980s that sought to locate and define the African bourgeoisie, what we used to call the African bourgeoisie. At that time, an enormous effort was put into differentiating salaried workers, you know, people with salaries, from management, from those who reproduce capital. And that work, and I'm thinking here of like Jean-François Bayard and Frederick Cooper, showed that employment was not a consistent marker of class status. They don't map onto each other directly. So for instance, some wage laborers remained below poverty levels, while skilled non-wage manual workers achieved real socioeconomic mobility. So it wasn't really very clear how you would categorize these groups of workers in terms of class status. So today, this kind of development economy approach to the middle class reminds us of the relevance of that prior research in African studies. There are a handful of anthropologists and sociologists who've taken an interest in this Africa rising narrative, and they claim that there's an increasingly established middle class across the continent. But they almost unanimously focus on a critique of the development economists, right? Or a critique of quantitative approaches. Their ultimate concern is to remind the development economists of the idea of class consciousness, or the extent to which socioeconomic groups define themselves and exhibit practices that are structured by their status as a class per se, right? And their reference is E.P. Thompson, And there's most, a lot of this work is coming out of South Africa, sociologists in South Africa looking at the middle class in South Africa. So these scholars turn to the historical sociology of the middle class in Africa, so as to situate today's analyses in these long-standing debates about the nature of production in Africa and the role of post-colonial states in class formation and reproduction. All of these recent publications are skeptical of the Africa Rising narrative, and they all raise questions regarding what exactly is being measured. So what struck me is that while these critiques are well-founded, I mean, I agree with the critique of the quantitative approach, in my view, they sort of miss the point. I agree with the critiques, but I think they miss the point. Maybe it's worth considering, and this is what I'm trying to do in this current work, it's worth considering the work of development economists in a different light. Instead of reviewing how they measure the magnitude of the middle class so as to insist they got it wrong, I'm interested in what is at stake in the very attempt to qualify the middle class in Africa, right? What's at stake in this very attempt to qualify the middle class in Africa? So the real question for this flurry of studies, reports, articles, et cetera, is who needs a definition of the middle class in Africa, right? Who needs that? So what follows actually just sort of considers that question. So while we can, again, quite rightly, critique their analyses for lack of attention to the structuring processes that give rise to class consciousness, right, such as the role of institutions and cultural norms, development economists and financial analysts are looking elsewhere, and their focus is on data. D-A-T-A, sorry, I hate not being able to see you. So in general, development economists' disagreement about how best to measure the middle class in Africa does not result from variations in data sets or different ways of defining income. It hinges on observations about the changing nature of financial flows to Africa. And their conclusion is that overall foreign aid has declined while private capital flows have increased very significantly over the past decade. Sarah, can you put the next slide? Oh, sorry, the next one. Thanks. So this is the most recent, very, very recent World Bank report, which shows capital inflows were 8% of GDP in 2017. And of those inflows, the average share of foreign direct investment increased from 24% in the 1990s to 75% in 2000s. That's a huge increase, and 75% is a large proportion. Next slide. So this rise in overall capital flows amounts to a six-fold increase over the past two decades, from 20 billion in 1990 to over 120 billion in 2012. So I don't know how well you can see this, but the official development assistance, like official aid, is in blue. Remittances, which I will talk about later, are in gray. And yellow, that last long band there, is private capital. So if we generalized, I'm skipping over a lot of stuff, analysis that I did in publications, but if we generalize, we can describe an emergent financial landscape as follows. Foreign direct investment is the largest source of private finance for sub-Saharan countries with a lion's share, excuse the bad metaphor, going to extractive industries, so mining, oil and gas, and to both Nigeria and South Africa. And also there is increasing international bond issuance, meaning African states issuing bonds on international capital markets. So the point is that the nature of capital flows is changing. And this is described as the beginnings of finance displacing agriculture and manufacturing on the continent. So typically development economists interpret this growth of the financial sector as an indicator of the emergence of the middle class, as I just said, and by association, democratic politics. You have a middle class, supposedly you have more democratic politics. Standing in the United States right now, I don't know about that, but here it's worth pausing to note that what is termed financialization in most contexts is being framed by social scientists as a form of modernization in the African context. This made me wonder, I find that actually troubling, and this made me wonder if it's indeed helpful to gloss the Africa Rising story as just another example of financialization. It seems to me today in a lot of social science, we're just reaching for that term, financialization, and I'm raising questions about it. It seems to me when we do that, we're sort of providing this kind of old school diffusionist history, right, from the core to the periphery. So before making that big leap and just saying this is just a question of financialization, movement from the core to the periphery, we need to study actual financial practices, right? What are they? How did they emerge? And how are they being institutionalized or not? Because they're not all institutionalized. So next slide, please, Sarah. Next one, sorry, I skipped that one. Thank you. So in the early days of this project, I assembled recent anthropological work on the global middle classes. And as you can imagine, this mostly relates to India and China. And I was struck, this is the book, The Global Middle Classes. It was published in 2012. I should say my colleague, Rachel Hyman, who is a wonderful, wonderful anthropologist, is a co-editor of this book, of this edited volume. And I was struck by this very, very strong statement for the study of the middle class formation made by the authors of the book. So I'm quoting, "Our job as historically and geographically minded anthropologists is to always start with the premise that middle classes or middle class practices are not real because they exist in theory, but rather because people exist in classed ways that can be theorized." Right, that sounds right to me. Like, it's not just because it exists in theory, obviously, it's because people exist in these class ways and then we theorize, right? So while I agree with that, I was really struck when I read it by the fact that, this is quite ironic, that last clause, right, people exist in class ways that can be theorized, could come straight from the mouth of a financial analyst. So in other words, if we take seriously this burst of private consultancy like the McKinsey report and financial analysis of these roaring lions economies, we see that they in part consist of efforts to discern how people live in classed ways that can be theorized. So this entails attempts to define a category of persons, like a class, right? A category of persons that constitute a consumer market, or to qualify a population as a market segment. And it entails theorization of ways to monetize that category. So in this research, I approach these recent attempts by financial analysts to qualify a middle class in Africa as points of insight into the production of the middle class as an object of knowledge. Or more specifically, the middle class as an actionable category of finance for various actors, right? Analysts, bankers, investors, consultants, etc. So discerning how people live in classed ways that can be theorized gives rise to marketing, investing, banking, and securitizing. And what I've learned, at least thus far, is that this theorization entails positing class in terms of future flows. So I'll explain that, right? Positing class in terms of future flows. So Michael Pettis, who's a professor of finance, once said, private capital flows to emerging markets, so to places like Brazil and South Africa and Nigeria, right, emerging markets, private capital flows to emerging markets are not necessarily driven by the investment climate in those countries. So it's not that private flows or private capital flows are going to Brazil or Nigeria because of the investment climate in Brazil or Nigeria. Instead, they're often the result of the investment climate in the host banking country. So the investment climate in London, for example, not in Brazil. So I'll explain this. And I'm wondering if this is the case for certain capital flows to Africa today, and what do we know about those capital markets? Next slide, Sarah, please. So this is just to help jog what I'm, help, you know, keep you focused on what I'm saying, but a recent Financial Times, This is Africa report on capital markets in East Africa maintains that the main goal for institutional investors, right, like a pension fund, is to develop the buy side, right? And this is not easy. I'm quoting the author's report. Mostly the findings point to a lack of investable products rather than a lack of demand as an explanation for the relatively low investment in private sector securities in Africa. So he's referring to East Africa, but note that demand here, demand, does not refer to East African middle-class consumers. It's not consumer demand in Africa. It refers to demand on the part of the institutional investors, like pension funds, in Europe, Russia, China, and maybe South Africa. So the challenge is to devise investable products in Africa or to create asset classes located in Africa, right? And when I talk about asset classes, I just mean like shares, like equity on stock markets, bonds especially, property, et cetera. So this is not to say that financial firms are not interested in developing domestic consumer markets, right? The big story we all hear, I'm assuming you hear this, is about efforts to bank the unbanked or efforts to bring new customers into the banking system as depositors. But the bank's overarching goal is to generate consumers of financial products, right? Definitely loans for local consumers, that's true, but also financial products that are sold on secondary markets, right? That are sold in London and Hong Kong. So we shouldn't forget, right? Markets for financial products are globally integrated markets. So to repeat, while there are efforts to constitute the middle class as a domain of consumption, right? Giving people bank accounts, financing the construction of shopping malls, there's also a focus on developing integrated capital markets on the basis of local asset classes. So what are local asset classes in Africa today? I'm setting aside, I should say, mining and the oil and gas sectors because they're very, very special. So the reports on the rising middle class and financial products produced by financial consultancies, right, like McKinsey and Deloitte, do concentrate on developing things like mortgage products for local consumers, but they also focus on capturing remittances as a new asset class. Sarah, can I have the next slide? Thanks. So before explaining their motivations, right, about developing these new asset class, I just want to say something about remittances to Africa. I don't assume everybody knows about them. So according to this most recent World Bank Migration and Remittances Brief, after two consecutive years of decline, remittance flows to low and middle income countries around the world, not just Africa, around the world, rebounded to a record level in 2017. Right, this was an 8.5% increase. You can see this on this graph to $466 billion. So while the share for sub-Saharan Africa is reported to stand at only 38 billion of that 466 billion, right, and that's in 2017, that still represents an 11.4% growth rate. And what's most important is that Nigeria ranks fourth amongst the top remittance receiving countries in the world in dollar terms. And Liberia ranks sixth in terms of remittances as a share of GDP. So I'm gonna say that again. Liberia ranks sixth in terms of remittances as a share of its GDP. 27% of Liberia's GDP, so a quarter of it, over a quarter of it comes from remittances. In Senegal, 14% of its GDP is based on remittances in 2017. Can you put the next slide? So I probably can't see this, sorry about that. I usually don't do this on Zoom, but so in 2018, the projected growth rate was 7% for Africa and only 4.6% for the world. Next slide. So, actually you can go back. I'll talk about that later, sorry. This is also, I can say in the Q&A, something about the post-COVID situation. But overall, the point is that remittances are the continent's largest source of foreign inflows after foreign direct investment. And for Nigeria, remittances are second only to oil exports as a source of foreign exchange. But in all countries, and this is really important, don't forget, I'm showing you World Bank reports. These figures underestimate the total amounts received, since most remittances flow through undocumented channels, mostly due to the high cost of transfer through money transfer operators, you know, like Western Union. So in sum, remittances to sub-Saharan Africa are predicted to increase. And what is crucial is that they are much more significant than this institutional reporting suggests. So while the Africa Rising narrative focuses on foreign direct investment and private equity flows, remittances are envisioned as an untapped source of economic growth. So initially, when I heard this, I thought that this was just a simple fact of like increased local demand, right? If you have more remittances, you have more local consumption. And that is, I think, because we have traditionally approached remittances as an aspect of migration studies, with a particular emphasis on their role in economic development, right? If you have more remittances going to Nigeria, more people have money in their pocket and they're buying more things in the grocery store, right? So the basic idea is that they contribute to increased consumption and potential productive investment. But the focus on the use of remittances for consumption has been displaced. Financial consultants do not study recipients' use of remittances, right? They're not studying what people are doing with that money in Nigeria. They do not care. Their focus is on remittances as a future flow. So how are remittances a future flow, and why is that significant? So remittances have been refigured, as a potential financial product, right? What I mean by that is just a tradable financial asset, something that you can trade on global markets. And that's because they have been defined, or I think redefined, as a future flow receivable. Leveraging remittances involves the use of future flow receivables as collateral on international capital markets. So there are revenue streams that are used as collateral on international capital markets. And this approach essentially means incorporating migrant financial flows into global financial markets. So two early examples, already back in 1996, the African Export-Import Bank helped arrange the first future flow securitization of remittances. It was actually for Ghana. It was a $40 million medium-term loan for a development bank backed by Western Union remittance receivables. In 2001, the African Exim Bank arranged a $50 million remittance-backed note for a Nigerian entity using MoneyGram receivables. So these are small amounts. They're more recent securitization, they're bigger amounts. I'm not gonna waste our time on walking through them. But at base, this entails securitization. Can you put the next slide, please? So when I give this talk, when I'm in person, I kind of walk through securitization. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm not gonna do that. I can talk about it in the Q&A. But securitization is just a financing technique used for risk management, for balance sheet management, moving risk around, and to obtain funding. So the most familiar to us, and maybe this is an American view, so not sure it applies everywhere, but is the securitization of subprime mortgages, right? Which is, you might know, as asset-backed securitization, right? So the subprime mortgage loans were repackaged and basically were used as collateral on global markets. So this is a process by which a bank converts stable and, most importantly, predictable cash flow streams in an asset pool, right? Like interest payments. So you have this predictable cash flow streams in an asset pool, right? Like interest payments into debt instruments, what we call securities. And those securities are tradable on capital markets. So in sum, this is what's on your slide. These are the most important points for the purposes of what I'm saying today. The current and future payments must be denominated in a hard currency, dollar or euro, right? And it can't be the currency of the originator, like Nigerian Naira. These receivables, secondly, must be creditworthy, right? They must have a good credit rating from the international agencies like Standard & Poor's or Moody's. So for example, US dollar receivables owed by a credit card company like Visa, right? Denominated in hard currency and predictable, steady stream that is predictable. And payment of the receivables must transpire outside of the originator's home country. So they must be paid to a legal entity that is established outside of Nigeria, like an LLC. Can you put the next slide? So we can see that personal and institutional remittances fulfill these criteria. And I was shocked when I saw this, but electronic remittances are ranked very, very high. So this is a technique for accessing financing on capital markets, but most importantly, it's a way to transform a sovereign credit rating. So the general rule is that when foreign debt is issued, so if I'm Nigeria and I'm going to issue a bond that people, you know, institutions can buy on a global capital market, I'm going to issue a bond to raise money. The bond cannot be rated above my external foreign currency debt rating. So this is known as the sovereign ceiling. And all you need to know about this is that the credit rating of the foreign debt, the bond, can't be rated higher than the country's foreign currency debt rating. So I'm paraphrasing a structured finance guide. The attraction of future flow of securitization is that it enables an originator, so like a development bank in Nigeria, which has a foreign currency debt rating that is either below investment grade or low investment grade, to improve its credit rating. So for example, Nigeria holds debt in dollars that is below investment grade. This allows the Nigerian Development Bank to issue securities and to obtain funding in the international capital markets with a rating that is actually higher than its foreign currency debt rating. And that is known as breaking the sovereign ceiling. And what I've discovered is remittance flows are central. They're crucial to this technique of breaking the sovereign ceiling. Because if remittances are accounted for, which they have not been until now, they can improve sovereign creditworthiness by increasing the level and the stability of foreign exchange receipts. Like suddenly, all these foreign exchange receipts are being accounted for. So if, for example, in Ethiopia, remittances contributed to a dramatic change in its external financing position, and that capital was used for infrastructure projects. So financial analysts and consultants argue that this increased access to international capital, right, this breaking the sovereign ceiling, increases the supply of investment. But it's important to note, and this is what I was saying before, the investors, those investing in the remittance-backed securities, are not obviously local middle-class African consumers. They're institutional investors located in London and elsewhere, Hong Kong. So remittances as a future flow are part of the extension of globally integrated financial markets. My point, and this is maybe something for anthropologists to think about, is that the representation of remittances as an element of financial markets has repositioned them outside of studies of migration and into the realm of financial analysis, and academic scholarship should take that into account. The impetus to securitize foreign currency future receivables, such as remittances to Africa, is part and parcel of the Africa Rising narrative. Africa Rising is not just about middle-class consumers in shopping malls. It's also a story about the drive to create new asset classes. And remittances are a new asset class. And this is because, remember my quotation from the Global Middle Classes edited volume, people exist in classed ways that can be theorized. So these migrant contributions are qualified as hard currency cash flows and securitized as investment grade future flows. That is, they are theorized as securities generating new or expanded capital markets. And in that sense, Africa is a new frontier for contemporary finance. So does this just amount to the diffusion of practices from the core to the periphery, right? Is Africa just once again the endpoint of the telos of the logic of finance capital, or the final horizon for financialization? Or can we best understand this process as co-constitutive or even driven by dynamics that are generated in African contexts, right? As my prior work has endeavored to show, margins are almost always frontiers. So in this instance, the margin of international finance is at the same time the frontier of non-bank financial institutions, right? But what does that mean? What does this margin frontier look like? And what does the anthropology of that margin frontier look like? If Africa has habitually been seen as the margin of international finance, the securitization of remittances sets it squarely in the expansion of global markets. But this requires actionable data, right? Or data that is standardized, aggregated, and translated into value forms, such as capital, right, or asset, and then monetized. The securitization of remittances depends on reliable documentation of data and on capturing the transfers that are not documented. Remember, most transfers to Africa bypass formal channels. And those that are channeled through international money transfer agencies are the most expensive in the world because those agencies, like Western Union, have exclusive partnerships with African banks and post offices. Also, international money transfer operators' payment systems and national bank payment systems are not integrated. So there's no shared platform and there is no shared standardized data. That interface is crucial for the production of actionable data for international financial firms because it's necessary for the standardization and then the aggregation of the data. So all I'm really saying is like there's no interoperability between the international and the national payment systems. So it's extremely difficult to capture remittances, despite all I just told you. It's extremely difficult to capture remittances for this data to value translation. And attempts to bank the unbanked, which we've all been writing about, that would increase the volume of transactions, right? That would increase the amount of data being processed by standardized systems, but they haven't been all that successful. The claim that the integration of unbanked money transfer clients is occurring in microfinance and in the remittance sector is largely overstated based on a lot of anecdotal evidence. Cash in, cash out, where like I don't have a bank account and my daughter who I'm sending money to in Ethiopia does not have a bank account, that remains the most common transfer, even for services like Western Union, right? It's cash in, cash out, nobody has a bank account. And commercial banks are not motivated to capture these transfers because they need really high volumes for it to be profitable. And there's a very high cost, or at least they say, of scaling infrastructure, right? Bringing bank branches to remote areas is very expensive. But can we have the next slide? And I'll be ending very soon. Where there are no bank branches, there are mobile phones. So mobile subscriptions, like just telecom subscriptions, right, to like whatever your local telecom is in sub-Saharan Africa are the lowest in the world. That's the top graph, the lowest in the world. But mobile money accounts far outpace other regions. That's the bottom graph. As we know, technological channels are replacing bank branches all over the world and they are expanding. And as our colleague Bill Maher shows in his work, non-bank payment systems are being developed very intensely in Africa by African telecoms like Safaricom, and I would add by fintech startups. What we do not know is whether this is a radical transformation of payment systems, and most importantly, whether there is currently a displacement of the traditional legacy banks like Barclays, right, or not. So my example of the securitization of remittances by national development banks, like Nigerian Development Bank, is an illustration of the specific mode of integration, right? In part, mobile money, like e-money, is being integrated into the traditional legacy bank system as a new asset class, right? For example, through remittances. And this new value form both preserves and transforms the cash economy, which is consequential from a political point of view. Could you put the next slide? Thanks. All this indicates that in order to understand how Africa is a new frontier for contemporary finance, we cannot start with the disembodied flow of financialization. Also, these initiatives don't always originate in London, Hong Kong, or New York, right? Some of them are in Nairobi or Lagos. And those that originate in Nairobi, Lagos, and Accra have varied relationships to investors in the rest of Africa and in Europe, North America, and South Asia. More concretely, we need to better understand not just where the financing comes from, but whether or not it reproduces or transforms long-standing credit relations. Both mobile money operators and financial firms that securitize the data they generate are involved in credit creation.
credit creation is traditionally the main role of the banking system and the central bank, right? That is increasing the money supply by extending credit relations. And in that sense, I think we're witnessing the endogenous emergence of a credit market through new forms of data, which merits study. Could you put the next slide? Next one. Thanks. So that raises the question, should anthropologists remain focused on microfinance and the unbanked? As we know, asset-backed securities are made from income streams that are derived from things like mortgages and loans, right? I walked you through future flow securitization, which made clear that what matters is collateral and credit scoring. We saw the remittance data is the basis for securities, which are the basis for balance sheet and foreign exchange reserve accounting, which are the basis for sovereign bond ratings. That is structured finance, or what Hannah Appel and I are calling high finance in the global south. And it's something we can study. The fallback position of anthropologists is to focus on consumption, right? Africans as consumers, on commodity production, right? The sale of data and data privacy issues, which are important, and on exchange, right? How exchange either confirms inequalities or produces new inequalities. That focus overlooks processes of capitalization, right? Capital formation, asset class creation, and investment practices. My questions are, what instruments or socio-technical devices are inherent to these practices? And what are the actor network geographies of these processes of capitalization? How and for whom is value generated? And here I want to include institutions like pension funds and private equity investors. Ultimately, these questions speak to the age-old anthropological focus on wealth allocation, but this project has forced me to bring into view new objects of inquiry. I've become increasingly aware, and I think hopefully literate, in the ways that finance is an information system. Therefore, one object of investigation, and this is my future work, is how data becomes a value form. All data cannot be monetized. And processes of monetization vary, sometimes significantly, and they fail often. And that's what I hope to study. So as my preliminary research has shown, these emergent forms, right, asset classes, credit, markets, these value forms, all of which are denoted by Africa Rising, are best understood as the spread of information systems, not just bank accounts. Local actors are probably not debating the ways in which Africa Rising denotes a measure of the middle class. I don't think people in Nigeria or Ghana are sitting around debating that, but they are definitely asking questions about the effects of these information systems and economic platforms, right? What are the power differentials that result from them? So Africa Rising is about global transformations of our political economies as much as it is about a new class of people on the continent. Studies that seek to demonstrate that Africa finally has a middle class sort of miss that point. I think they're just another modernization story and they're anachronistic. So I just want to return to the question I asked at the outset. I asked, who needs a definition of the middle class in Africa? What I presented illustrates that what is at stake is less an emergent mass of consumers who will contribute to the expansion of supermarket chains than an emergent set of asset classes and the expansion of integrated global capital markets. So in the interest of time, I'll stop there. And thank you so much for listening through all that.
Thank you very much. This is one of the really big downsides of Zoom is that we can't make noise whether you're in Germany or, that was, from my perspective, absolutely fabulous. And while people are gathering their thoughts and getting ready to, you know, do their blue hand, if they want to ask a question, please do use the blue hand function. It makes it possible for me to see you. I just want to make one comment and ask one brief question. This completely overlaps, people might be surprised to hear this, overlaps with work that I'm doing at the moment, what it brilliantly shows, I think, is that what I've been working on for a while is that, that state borders is only one kind of border regime that works in the world. And there are many others. And one of the other most important ones is a financial bordering structure. And that the dynamics of that works very differently from the political state borders system, or even the bordering structures of religious institutions and so on and so forth. So this, I think, put real bones on the claim I've been making for the Mediterranean region. We're trying to do mapping of the financial flows across the Mediterranean region of this question that of how the connections and disconnections between different parts of the world are being rearranged according to these kinds of classification and information systems. And you gave an absolutely wonderful example of how that is working in this context. So I have so many things to ask, but one of the things that I maybe will start with is a very small provocative question is, should we be replacing one kind of class for another in looking at this?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I've never ever thought of that, so thank you. One thing I would love to know more about your mapping project, that the research in the Mediterranean, it's just crucial. I mean, especially considering, I don't know if it relates to what's happening with migration in the Mediterranean. I'd love to hear you say more about that. What I presented is part of a collaboration I'm currently involved in with Hannah Appel, who's at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. We just actually got a National Science Foundation grant for this. And one of the things we're really interested in is precisely that mapping, because she's very attuned. She's looking at a more, I'm looking at FinTech. She's looking at a sort of more regional level of, you know, why capital crosses certain frontiers and certain borders and not others, right? She's really interested in that geography. And one of the things that this is very specific to our context, but that we've honed in on that we didn't know about before really was the difference between soft currency economies and hard currency economies, which plays a lot into that. So we have like a specific way of thinking about what are the things we need to focus on in order to answer that question and eventually create that map. I guess the thing for me, so that's one thing. I'd love to hear the ways that you're thinking about what are the vectors that matter in terms of why there are these kind of differentials across borders. That's kind of separate from the class question. I assume what you mean is why replace middle class with asset class? Is that what you?
It was, yeah. Yeah, or should we? Maybe.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I guess I think you heard it in my presentation. My frustration with the debate that I was following was that, like, the development economist work was actually quite interesting, and my anthropology colleagues and a lot of people in sociology as well were kind of. It was just felt to me like this age-old debate of like they're quantifying, you shouldn't be quantifying. And I agree. It's not like I disagree, but I wasn't really learning anything. And I guess what I realized was, like, you know, standing in the United States right now, I can say, trust me, the middle class is an extremely heterogeneous category, as we just found out in our election, right? And as we found out in 2016. So I guess I was just frustrated with, like, this, the middle class is such a heterogeneous category. And I think in looking, you could do something else, which look at how it's constituted differently instead of just trying to define it. That would be one project. I think what happened for me is that I became interested in the actual capitalization of these new markets. What they were describing in these McKinsey reports was actually not so much a concern with, like, how many middle-class people are in this shopping mall. Right, or how many people own their home, or how many people have piped in sewage and electricity and appliances, right? That's what the development economists are looking at, and that's worthy.
But that's not what McKinsey is looking at. McKinsey is looking at how capitalization can take place, is and can. They're sort of in this liminal place of like describing and forecasting. And that is about constituting new asset classes, because that's capitalization, for better or worse, is based on that. So maybe it's not an appropriate replacement. That's a good question. I feel like as long as I'm looking at the question of how it's happening, how it's being constituted, and not trying to essentialize some like class of something, that the substitution would make sense for me. But I'm not sure that fully answers your question, but that's how I see it.
No, it does. I mean, we can carry on with this conversation for a while. I'm going to pass on to some other questions now, but it does partly answer my question. I think the point that I was pointing towards is that asset classes get around state border focused research, because it divides the world differently, because there are hierarchies and there are divisions between different parts of the planet according to asset classes, but they work, as you described, very differently from the way state borders do.
It also depends. Yeah. I mean, asset classes denominated in local, like Nigerian Naira, are not as mobile as an asset class denominated in a dollar.
Exactly. So there are overlaps. So that's that. Yeah, it's that I was getting at. There are some questions piling up. First from Ilana Gershon, and then Jeremy Gould, if his mic works. Otherwise, I'll read out his question. Ilana.
Thank you. This was such an imaginative talk. And so it was really lovely to think with you, but I'm not sure I'm thinking as quickly alongside. So I want to ask a question that I have a number of questions, but I'm going to ask the one that follows up a bit with Sarah's. You see at the end of your talk that what you want to study is the failures of how one tries to transform things into assets or into instrumentalize financialization. And throughout your talk, I was thinking about Samoan exchange systems as the ways through which I think of remittances. So I'm kind of amazed at the ability to instrumentalize remittances. And so I'm wondering, what does failure look like? Like, can kind of how when it seems like everything can be instrumentalized. And so I'm really curious about the failures.
Yeah, it's a great question. I also, trust me, in this research, I really was looking at this Africa Rising. I was not expecting to find remittances and securitization of remittances. That was a big discovery. And that's the fabulous thing about research, right? However, to answer your question, I think that the interesting thing about this, and I would say this is true for many digital platforms, it's not like the money is going into the banking system necessarily, right? You could be in London sending money for your daughter to pay her school fees back in Ethiopia, and you don't have a bank account and she doesn't have a bank account, right? It's cash in, cash out. But by capturing the data, and that's why suddenly the phones and the fintech platforms have become instrumental. Don't forget mobile money and all the things that are happening on phones, right? The banking on phones, they're not banks. The transactions on phones, right, are not happening through the banking system, right? They're not like guaranteed deposit structures, right? So it's very different if I have on my phone, which is somewhere, my Citibank app. That's like banking with Citibank, just happens to be on a phone, right? It's very different if I have a wallet with mobile money, right? Or if I'm using a fintech platform, that is not going through necessarily through the banking system. Right. So and Bill Maurer writes about this, so I'm not going to get into it here. But I guess the point is that we assume that these are really effective. You know, all the data is monetized, you know, and it's like all the data is extracted, and like it's actually a mess. And if you go and talk to industry people, they talk a lot about having data dumps, about having problems with like, machine learning, coming up with these patterns, and then they don't know how to monetize it. And it's actually not, you know, all that effective. So one of the things is that the remittance is, it was hard for me to get my mind around this, but it isn't actually like there's more money piling up in the treasury, you know, that wasn't accounted for before. It's actually a notational, you know, value. And it's only the data being, it's now only the data being processed. But I think, so that's one thing is about, that's why I'm interested in the failures. I think we, the assumption that all of this is like so effective, you know, is one thing that I'm hesitant about, because that's not what I'm hearing. And secondly, I think it does hedge this financialization flow kind of, you know, kind of metaphor that we've taken on. I mean, financialization is ruthless, right? And it's happening in all sorts of ways in all of our lives and in lives in Africa, obviously. But I don't think that it's as always effective as we say. And what Hannah and I are really concerned to pay attention to is when we speak to finance people like who are in Nigeria, for example, or in Ghana, there's a politics to this that really matters to them. And this loops back to Sarah's question. If you have bonds denominated in local currencies, let's say you have remittances, and you issue a bond not denominated in euros or dollars, but denominated in local currencies, you are finally able to circumvent the hold, the monopoly that Barclays has, you know, or that the legacy, when I say legacy banks, they're mostly old colonial merchant banks that still exist and still run in kind of the old boys club, you know, version of giving credit. And so for these young, you know, cohort of finance people, they feel this is like an anti-colonial movement almost. It's like the last phase, you know. And so we also want to pay attention to like their political claims about this. You know, so you can be sitting in New York City with my colleagues at New York, and they're like, oh my God, this is so horrible. You know, they're financializing, which is true. But then when you talk to the local young finance people, they're like, screw this. Like, this is our last, you know, thing standing are these colonial merchant banks. So the politics of it, I think, is interesting. Long-winded answer. But the point about financialization was just to not take it as like inevitably north to south and inevitably efficient.
Yeah, that's great.
Can I follow up and with a little comment? Having you describe this sounds very similar to the kind of long historical roots that Stephen McCoura just published a book this month about the problems of creating GDP for an African country. And how difficult it was to produce this data that could then be translated into GDP. And this sounds like they're kind of long historical roots in the problems of economic data.
Can I ask you to send
it? I will send it to you. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. That's great. Thank
you. Maybe actually you could share it in the chat with everybody. That would be great. Thank you. We've got a couple more questions coming up. Next from Jeremy Gould. Jeremy, can you see if your microphone will work? Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
You can. Okay. Yeah. Janet, thank you very much. That was really stimulating and innovative. And my question is follows a little bit up on that. Maybe you've already answered it actually, but I work in Southern Africa, and what I've been seeing, this isn't my focus, but what I've been seeing is the robust concentration of African-owned or joint-owned banks, which are not simply the old colonial merchant banks, but they are now they are locally driven by local capitalists, and I, from what I've understood from a lot of the discourse, so they're not, I wouldn't say they are, you know, anti-capitalist or anti-globalization, but they are definitely try to nurture a patriotic or a nationalist discourse about the power of local capital and local investments, and in keeping the foreign foreign powers at bay. So this an ethos of political sovereignty, resistance against the North, which resonates strongly in a lot of jurisdictions. Is this something that you've also seen, or have I mistaken this? And the other part of the question is that my understanding is that a lot of what's been driving these banks is their investments in telecoms. That's been really the a lot of the motor of the country. Also extractive industries to some extent, but those are usually beyond their initial reach. But they can get into telecoms, and they've been and these are regional banks. I mean, they have, you know, they're in Zambia and in Zimbabwe and South Africa and Botswana and Namibia all at the same time in building up these regional markets. So just, I wondered if that was something that was interesting for you to comment on.
Yes, thank you so much. We should stay in touch because, one of the things is Hannah and I put this project together and we were like ready to go, and then COVID happened. But my short answers to your two questions, comments are yes and yes. The research we were able to do before COVID was like in industry conferences, mostly in like London, various people in various sectors of finance, but all from Africa. And absolutely, the nationalist, that was, I was sort of my answer to Alana, was along those lines. I absolutely saw the same thing. But interestingly, we're focused on West Africa. So that's something, definitely kind of Nigeria, Ghana, we're definitely hearing that. And absolutely, I do think Southern Africa is different because of Safaricom, because of capital markets in South Africa are so developed compared to the rest of the continent, because of Kenya, there's nothing to be said about, mobile money in Kenya and the platforms in Kenya as well being just much more kind of, developed or advanced or whatever word we want to use. So I think that it's the reason why we chose, or I chose to do the research in Ghana, we're like, I've never been, to be honest. And Hannah's interested in EcoBank, which is a regional bank, is precisely for the reason you're saying. We're kind of interested in how these regional banks are positioning themselves. And there is definitely investment in the telecoms. Again, not to the extent as you would find in South Africa or even East Africa, East Southern Africa. I would love to talk to you about this offline sometime.
Let's do that. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Next, we've got Sirpa.
Hey, thank you for the fascinating paper. And I think you mentioned that the selling of data as one new form of way of forming capital. And I remember that recently Nick Gouldrey has come up with he came up with the concept of data colonialism or something like that. And I just, seeing discussions on that concept, I'm just wondering if he has any ethnographic data to show what's really happening, because maybe this is one of the failures that we tend to think that these social media companies are doing great business with data extraction, and especially from the developing countries. But are they really doing? Are you going to look at this? What's your take on this issue?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that question. That actually goes to the heart of what sort of motivates this project kind of just generally, meaning not really necessarily about Africa. We started at the New School something called the Platform Economies Research Group, partly because people working, I mean, there's someone working on Amazon Web Services, there's someone working on supply chains, like there's someone working in China on insurance, data use in insurance, medical insurance and pharmacy. Like there are a whole array of projects. If you're interested, I can give you the link, but I won't waste our time on it now. But really we started this, it started as a reading group. It's now kind of a research network, but we did it precisely because of your question.
because we felt like a lot of our, you know, anthropologists sort of relate to the game. And I think it's because you can't open the black box of the algorithm ethnographically. And so, you know, I think media studies had a big influence on how we approach data, you know, digital technologies and platforms and data in general, which is very metaphorically, right? Like the cloud has become sort of like a metaphor. Like, I don't know what an algorithm the cloud really is. And likewise, things, you know, like algorithmic logic, or like, I don't, what is that, you know? So, and I really recommend someone who's part of our group is Paul Dorish, who's at University of California, Irvine, who really, he's a data scientist, but he's an anthropologist as well. And I think it's really worthwhile to, even though we feel this urgency about things like data privacy, and that is urgent, and I no doubt about that, but I do think from a research point of view, we really need to think much more carefully about how we study these things. Metaphors aren't really so great, and you know, I don't know how much they really tell us. And it's a challenge. And that's why I put so much emphasis in my talk. I'm sorry if it seemed kind of like tedious, but I really am focusing on the data to value translation. Like, how does this data become not monetized, but how does it even become a form that can then be monetized? The data has to be, you know, I'm not going to get into the details, but become a form like capital, right? Or, you know, asset that can then be monetized. And I think we do all this shortcutting of like data is monetized, and you know, and I just, it's not, if you really start looking into it, it's not all that easy. So I would be, I'm sure there is data colonization happening. It's the same thing with financialization. I just think we just need to really slow down and think very carefully about methods. And these kinds of questions. Cause I think what I'm seeing is definitely it's much more difficult to monetize data than I ever imagined. So, yeah, thank you for the question.
Thank you. There's lots I could say there, but we have a list of people coming up now. So let's see if we can fit them in. Suvi is next.
Okay, thanks so much. Thank you, Janet Reutemann. That was really fascinating. This was all very new for me. So my question, apologies if my question kind of goes off course. I'm an anthropologist working in China. So your talk made me think of the news, the main news coming from China over the past 2 weeks, which is obviously about the Ant Group, the, you know, a member of the Alibaba, the highest value fintech company, and this halt of the IPO, which is supposed to be the largest IPO, and the halt of it, which is of course a very political effort, kind of monitored by the Communist Party. There's rumors around why it was halted, but one of the rumors is very much Jack Ma kind of stepping over the line and making the statement of the limitations of the central bank in comparison to fintech companies. So again, apologies if my question goes offline, but I'm not sure how much Alibaba has penetrated across the African continent, but of course China has. And then also this made me think of, and if this was in relation to Ilana Gershon's question, the kind of the failures of these fintech companies, it made me think of, I think it was last month, Uganda's, the mobile money, the hacking of this mobile money network. And if I just checked online, there was $3.2 million US dollars stolen across 2000 mobile banks across Uganda. So it made me think of things like security, which you mentioned during your talk. I was wondering if how much do you refer to security and politics and so forth across, you know, these different fintech companies I think that was my question, but thank you. That was really fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a great question. It's an excellent question. And I've been following the China story, Ma and the whole thing. That is definitely Chinese politics. I would be curious if Stephen Gold has insights about China's presence in sort of the fintech world in Southern Africa. I haven't done enough of this research on the ground So I don't want to say, I'm just not going to speculate. I haven't really seen, most of the investment is really coming from what I've seen, from London, Gulf States, not so much China. But then again, you know, I haven't been on the ground about this. So can't really say I'm seeing that though. I'm not really looking at the security questions about, you know, data breaches and hacking and stuff like that. I will say though, there is a big political question here, and I raised it. I mean, there are many, but I raised it in passing in my presentation, is that the money transferring through fintech platforms is not guaranteed, right? So in the United States, we have like FDIC, which is federally insured. So if I have however much in a bank here in New York City, if there's a run on the bank, $100,000 of my deposit is guaranteed by the treasury, right, by the government. That's not the case for fintech. They're not banks. They don't have banking licenses. That's why I call them non-bank financial institutions. And the world over, this is a problem, right? Because they are expanding. And I think COVID, you know, I think we're all hearing that COVID has made them even more relevant and desirable. You know, people, the contactless world is definitely emerging. And I think there are good reasons for a lot of this. It does make, if you talk to some people in Africa, they want cheaper forms of payment and they should have them. You know, at the same time, you know, there's other political questions here though, because the unbanked still have problems in this country anyway. I mean, there's a lot of different ways of debating this, but they're not guaranteed. And so that is a huge, there's huge like risk in this. Also, the part of why the local governments are gonna shut a lot of this down is because they lose control of the money supply. So the central bank, there's credit creation happening, which I passed over, but the central bank loses control of the money supply and through interest rates. And that is the big, you know, the big battle that's going to happen. And, you know, and that's probably why a lot of the large banks will end up buying out these fintech companies and just solving the problem. But, you know, so the politics of this are to be seen, and they're complicated. And it's an excellent, excellent question. Yeah. Not so much the data security question that I know about them. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay, so we've got four more questions coming up, and just over 10 minutes. So we'll have to be concise with your questions if you can. Next is Andy Graham.
Hello, and just to echo others, thanks for this really thought-provoking talk. In short, I guess my question is, where is the money going? But with a little more detail, I was taken with, or I appreciated your criticism of development economists as being trapped in this old model where foreign direct investment translates into increased production and consumption, hence photographs of shopping malls in Time and The Economist. But you're pointing to something really new, new asset classes, new ways in which data is being valued and monetized, new systems of exchange that circumvent traditional banking. And I'm curious if you have like any indication on where the money is going? Is it translating into new forms of capital flow, new forms of capital extraction? That is the new mechanisms that you're identifying, are they actually producing new ways in which an investment and extraction materialize on the ground?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And that's the concluding question of the National Science Foundation grant proposal that Hannah and I submitted. So we share your question. That's hopefully what our research will document and show and have something to say about. I can say just from like preliminary, this is more intuitive and preliminary research answer, is there a financial elite emerging in various African countries, not all African countries, but we are seeing that, and it is through a lot of these emerging markets and emerging asset classes, and meaning these emerging asset classes and the markets they give rise to. And some of the bonds, and this is where there's a lot of kind of debate, are, you know, infrastructure bonds. So some of this is raising money for infrastructure projects, right? There was a big dam in Ethiopia, but that also led to a lot of civil strife, right? Actually, the Ghanaian finance minister just announced a bond that he's an international bond that he's that the government will be issuing based on royalties coming from the gold mines. And you know, there was a lot of flack about this, you know, kind of leveraging the country's future, you know, these are good questions they're asking him. And he was really funny though. He was like, the British treated the gold like trinkets for centuries. And like, why? He was kind of like, this wasn't a problem when the colony was doing it, you know? So like, you know, the politics of this are really interesting, you know, but I do think that the two answers I can give you as from the preliminary research is this financial elite is emerging. I guess that's my question is like, do you call that a middle class? You know, and who owns the means of production? Is that still the question we're asking? You know, and I don't have answers to that because I haven't done the research yet. But in infrastructure, and a lot of the money is ostensibly going into infrastructure and to paying the interest on prior loans, right? Prior obligations. So refinancing those. That's what I know right now. Yeah. So not the most satisfactory answer, but yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's obviously a watch this space situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrea.
Hi, I mean, that was absolutely mind-blowing and I really enjoyed it. I'm afraid, I'm a bit scared that this question is going to sound a bit naive in case I've missed something, but is there any sort of regional pooling of data? I'm thinking, you know, sort of cross-border. Like if somebody in Benin is to use a mobile money transfer, where does that data become recorded? Is it recorded in Lagos or does it stay in the country? And of course, then there'd be a separate question, which is what does this mean for sort of regional power and regional security? But just after the, you know, if you know anything about, you know, just it, I just wanted to know if there was any sort of regional.
Yeah, actually, you could be sitting in a venture capital or a fintech plat. That's the question they're asking.
Right.
This is a really good question. I guess you probably heard my frustration. It was one day. It was probably a good idea to be studying like you know what's this banking the unbanked question. I think though we've been digging a hole with that. And I really think that the question right now, and Bill Maurer's work is really helpful in this regard, is cross-border payments are like really, really where, you know, where everyone's focusing in Africa, right? And absolutely, and they're huge. I do think a lot of it is, if I think back to like, you know, fiscal disobedience, right? Before there were fintech platforms, but there were certainly a lot of cross-border trade, right? And a lot of cross-border payment happening without those infrastructures. So I think that it's something that we just have not been documenting because we have had that like national focus. And so it's a great question. Certainly the fintech platforms are focusing on it, as I just said, but what I really want to do in this research is to look at how, it's to answer your question really. I'm sorry, I'm saying this again because you all have your questions.
Oh, no, sorry if I've asked something that's already been answered.
There's a reason why it's important is because what I hear from new fintech, you know, startups is that's what they want to do is capture that cross-border data and that's where they get into this like real like muck over standardization, right? And because of the different interfaces and different APIs and like that, the technical part of it, right? But that is precisely what they're focused on. And they see this as like, I think more of it is kind of like, has been there always, you know? But they see it as like this new, it is true that the flip phones have amplified it pretty dramatically so. But that is where they see like the real data question is there. It's not so much, there's a little bit of like north-south regional transfers and things like that. But that's where their focus is. And the real question for them, and I'm speaking anthropologically, like this is their question. So I'm like emic. it's not like I believe that this is a good thing. just to say that.
Sure.
Your question is, how can they credit score? How can they credit score, and how can they do risk analysis in Africa?
Right.
Which today, to date, is, you know, difficult because of the what they call the quality of the data, right? Mm-hmm. So that's really what they're focusing on, is the way that these cross-border transfers will give them the ability to credit score eventually. Okay. Eventually.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
No, thank you. Yeah.
Final two questions, and we have 5 minutes, so we should be able to get through them.
I can go 5 minutes over, Sarah.
Okay, Thomas, and then Matti. Thomas.
Yeah, hi. Also, thanks. Really fascinating paper, and I'd have a ton of questions, and this was really interesting because working from or on Papua New Guinea, Papua New Guinea was the first place where I encountered mobile money much earlier than, for example, in Finland. And so I really need to check your work, because there's incidentally not much on Papua New Guinea that I've learned on the topic. But I'd, you mentioned your research group and algorithms and research and platform, and I think that's a fascinating question, especially the part about ethnographically studying it. So if you have you mentioned you have data scientists working on that, and that's fascinating. Do you have for example, people working on the end users, or people whose lives are affected by these algorithms? I'm asking this because I used to work as a bike courier for a black platform company, and there the algorithmic logic becomes very tangible, and it's interesting because you don't know exactly how or why it works, but and I think this was shared by many of our colleagues, that you can predict it, you get a sense, a working sense of it. And I'd be sort of fascinated to learn more about is that studied, or has that been studied, or stuff like that. And do you have people working on ethnographically on it? Because I think that's what anthropologists also do well, is study how this affects people. But thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's really precisely our concern. So what we did was it's a new group, so there's not that much that has been concluded in terms of the research. It's a very, very new group, only since kind of a year and a half, 2 years. But our concern was to develop a network of they're not only anthropologists, but social scientists, let's put it that way, and information or data scientists, or people working already working like Paul Dorish, who have both in terms of training. There are a variety of projects represented in the group. The ultimate concern is the end user. But there's a prior question, and here I'm sort of paraphrasing Paul, but is it there might be an outcome. And often, for example, often you hear it's the algorithms produce racial bias, for example. And of course they do, for one, horribly, sadly, right? But for me, that's not a conclusion, that's a starting point. Because often that's stated as a conclusion, the algorithm produces racial bias. And I'm that is a starting point for the research into, I wanna know how, right? And I think it's really, actually really hard to show how. Sometimes you can just show an algorithm that uses weights, W-E-H, as in heavy weight, right? A zip code, right, heavily, that would be an obvious, you could show how if you took the zip code out, you wouldn't be putting that bias in, right? But I've been at industry conferences in New York City where I hear people in the mortgage industry saying that, they know that. But we have to stop doing that, right? So I think that we assume a naivete on one hand, and then the other hand is, as Paul says, you might have an outcome, but in the operations,
right? In like the digital technology operations part of this, there are many algorithms interacting with each other. And we don't know, like it's really hard to say, right? What the like, how the output was produced, right? And so, and this is totally the case in machine learning. So that we're actually trying to develop, like what would the anthropology of that be? Not just standing at the end user point, making assumptions about the technology, right? But actually doing prior work. And it is not easy because it's, you know, you can't like be inside, you can't do participant observation of an algorithm, right? But I do think we're trying as much as we can to become literate, you know, just as you can for other things, right? You learn a language when you go, you know, to Papua New Guinea, or, you know, so we're sort of taking it in that spirit. And it's a very new group. So, you know, we will have those end user studies in a couple of years, but yeah, that's the goal. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Finally, we've gone just a little bit over time, but Matti, quick question, quick answer.
Okay, I'll be very quick. You kind of answered already I was thinking about these transfers as exchanges or something. What goes one way, what goes the other way? And you answered Andy's question, I think, with these infrastructural bonds and so forth. But I was thinking of pension funds. If I were to go to a Finnish bank, and the banker would be selling me a pension fund, would Africa Rising, if there were a basket called Africa Rising, would this be something that they would be able to put a face on? Or would it be kind of the professional kinds of figures and algorithm trading and stuff? Or would they be able to package this in a way that they'd be able to sell me Africa Rising? So I'm kind of asking, is this is this an insider trading kind of a thing, or is it a publicly marketable thing at the kind of European end or the investor end?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a really good answer for you. You know, I think it's because I don't entirely understand. I mean, well, let me ask it this way. It is true that infrastructure bonds were sold as kind of like good bonds. Like if you don't want to buy into the mining company, right, you can buy an infrastructure bond that's going to help with green energy. That's a huge, it's like a lot of, it's not a huge market, but it's a lot of impetus around that. So if you go to the industry conferences, the finance industry conferences, that are only related to Africa, which is like what I've been doing, you get a lot of people from Scandinavia, actually. And that's like, it's a big kind of like that we can invest in. And we want to make money off of that. And that's a good place to make money, right? And a lot of it is, you know, solar, you know, a lot of it is focused around energy. But I don't know if that's what you meant. I mean, that is kind of like a sort of separate put your face on it market. That's how I understand it. That does exist, yes. And then there's a whole lot of it that is just, you know, algorithmic, part of whatever, you know, typical investment strategies that pension funds have, you know, for sure. Yeah. It's an interesting question. Yeah, I answered it, Matti.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you so much. Obviously, we could go on and on, but this was absolutely fabulous. And hopefully within the not too distant future, we'll have you over to Helsinki for a longer conversation. And we're very much looking forward to the outcome of this research. So thank you so much.
Thank you all for showing up and for the great questions. Really excellent questions. So, and I hope to see you, someday in Helsinki.
I hope you have a good rest of your day and weekend.
Yeah, thank you all.
Bye to everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.